May it please the court.
It does. You may proceed.
Susan Robertson on behalf of Relator Emerus Top of America. It's unusual that we seem like we're just following the argument. We have a different case number, but the one following me is from the same case. So Emerus and the Johnson & Johnson defendants have a different relator, but we have many of the same issues. In our case, this court issued its Barron opinion, and 6 days later, Judge Burleson set the Blaze case separately for trial. Following the concurrence, Emerus renewed its motion, which it had always filed when the pleadings were amended, to sever and transfer the venue as to Michael Blaze's claim. There is no dispute that the only proper venue for the wrongful death claim of Michael Blaze's wife is in St. Louis County. That's where the Blaze claim originated. It was filed in St. Louis County, removed. It was on the eve of trial, and Mr. Blaze sought permission to dismiss his case and come join the St. Louis City. The defendants objected to that. Over the objection, he was allowed to join, and he's in the first, second, third, and fourth amended petition. But it is the relator's position that we welcomed the guidance given in the concurrence opinion. All of us in the room are familiar with how venue has been handled and been frustrated by when writs were denied and then you try to raise it on appeal, and it is very difficult to prove that there's been something wrong in the handling of the case from the locale in which it was tried unless you've got some other error. So it was welcome to see. We followed what was set forth in the concurrence and are here because we welcome the writ being granted preliminarily and urge it to be made permanent because it is a mess. Emerus stands alone, different from Abbott Labs and different from J&J. Emerus has always maintained the position and will continue to maintain there is no general or personal jurisdiction as to Emerus, as to any of the plaintiff's claims, whether Missouri or non-Missouri. That is not the subject of this writ, but the beginning point in Barron that says, well, jurisdiction's not at issue, and the Abbott Lab case wasn't there. As to Blaze, there is not a jurisdiction challenge made by Johnson & Johnson. But to be clear, when we go through the analysis of what is fair and appropriate in the interpretation of the rules and statutes on venue, it is very welcomed, and we urge the court to make the writ permanent to send Blaze there. But there is a whole larger situation that occurs. You would have cases that say venue presumes jurisdiction has been decided. It has not. It will be decided, and we may be back here again, one or more of sides of us, on this issue. But we have what we urge the court is to understand. There are probably 15 separate case files in St. Louis City within those groups of plaintiffs. So although we're here on the writ on Mr. Blaze and the analysis of whether or not when one is set for trial, should it be in, as Judge Stith, your questions have indicated, and it is our position, it looks, smells, acts like it is a severance. Even though it might be a separate trial, it doesn't act like that because it is in the, there have been five cases tried to final judgment, and Emerus has had a defense verdict in three. And so Fox and Ristison, which were first and on appeal, are appealed by J&J. Giannini is the third one, and we are both in that one. And then there is Daniels, which was a defense verdict for everyone, and then there's Slept. So there have been five, some from Hogan's, some from Swan. But understanding that Judge Burleson has a whole bunch of other ones, of which he is, and after the preliminary writ in this case, indicated he'll just set all of them for trial. And so there are, coming up in June and September, potentially 100 plaintiffs that the respondent wants to go through trial.
Can you explain that all for one single trial or seriatim, one after the other, or what?
And that's why I think it's important, although we're outside the record and directive of the writ, but to understand what's really going on, So you have the Swan case here where nothing is happening in Swan because the preliminary writ was issued. So there are no trial settings currently in Swan. Hogan's is the one that this court has a pending application for transfer in Fox from the J&J defendants. Then there is Ristison and Giannini currently on appeal in the Eastern District that come from those cases. But from Swan,
This one is a multi-plaintiff case.
They're all multi-plaintiff, yes.
So there's four multi-plaintiff cases.
There are 15.
15 multi-plaintiff cases.
So to be so, and the reason I brought this up, Your Honor, is that you're looking at Swan where, depending on what happens in Swan with Mr. Blaze, it's the defendant's relators hope that you make the writ permanent, Mr. Blaze goes to St. Louis County. But in following up on some of your questions, and I think it was asked very early on, what happens if the judge sets them all for trial at one time? And that is, in fact, what has happened following the issuance of this preliminary writ. But understand, those are all, so there are one set in June that has maybe 22 plaintiffs, and then two set in September that have maybe 66 and, I don't know, 18.
So they're going to be all tried together?
Well, that's one of the reasons that we're here appreciating the dialogue. The way that they are now is just set all of them for trial and work them up. And so but they are not all the same plaintiffs. These are different plaintiffs' law firms with different discoveries starting from the beginning. So I want to make sure I come back to
answer.
Are
they all the same injuries?
They're all talc cases. But in each of them, you have, as Mr. Price alluded to, you have in Swan one plaintiff. Each of the petitions, and we've had all of them in the index and the exhibits, there is one paragraph as to venue. In all four petitions, the venue paragraph is identical. There is venue because Ms. Swan was first injured in St. Louis City. So you have one paragraph for one plaintiff, and the 65 others are out of state, Blaze in state, but first injured in St. Louis County. That type of situation is in all of the about 15 current cases that are filed in St. Louis City. There were some in Kansas City, but a lot have gone to an existing MDL out in New Jersey, I think. And so, am I answering your question? So I want to get to the issue of why it is important for this preliminary writ to be granted when the trial judge actually enters an order that sets less than all for trial. And it is the relator's position that the concurrence and the hope that it would be adopted, because the appellate courts are listening. Not that they don't pay attention to writs that are being filed, but everyone wants guidance on what to do. It is the defendant Emerson's position that the cases should progress in a logical fashion and jurisdiction should have long been adjudicated before you ever get to venue. But we're here on venue and we'll take it. And when we go to venue and discovery on jurisdiction is completed, then we'll have a jurisdiction decision made, hopefully in the appropriate venue. But the next question arises, what happens? Does this case mean anything? And can judges just set the whole thing, the whole cause for trial? What does that mean? They're absolutely correct. It's untriable to have 22 plaintiffs come up for trial from 22 other states with 22 sets of law on causation, punitive damages, etc. So there has been.
But I'll stop you there. But I mean, this is key based off the majority opinion in Abbott, is that at that point in time, you've got a potential appealable issue where you could show prejudice. If all those cases were tried together and all that evidence came in and all those separate instructions and issues were sent to the jury, there would be a pretty good argument that there is prejudice. I'm not saying it would exist, but there could be an argument, and then maybe writ is not appropriate at that point. And maybe an appeal is the way to handle the matter.
Not when venue. I mean, the majority, so back to where I started, majority opinion was welcomed
but getting back to your question,
in the venue analysis.
But my concern is what you're arguing is that if the court issues a writ in this case, makes the writ permanent, then the way that's going to be read is that let's not separate these individuals for trial, that we're going to keep them all together for trial. And I know that's not what you want to have happen.
Absolutely not.
But is that what your concern and what you're telling this court is that is a concern that could happen?
Well, the first role that I have is to give comfort to the rest of the court adopting the concurrence when you do have the situation where a trial judge sets one for trial. Okay. So that's issue number one.
And let's stay on that. Although it's not quoted in your brief, it's quoted in Johnson & Johnson's brief, Judge Bertelsen made an effort to explain why he thought there would still be efficiencies to be gained by trying multiple plaintiffs, if not all of them together, after they tried some initial cohort of cases individually. Why was that thinking, that there were still efficiencies to be gained by joinder and by denying severance, why was that an abuse of discretion?
Not as to Michael Blaze, because discovery was done and he set it for trial. So any efficiencies that you may have argued, and again, these cases, the reason I brought up the five, is the five have all been tried absolutely independent of each other. The verdicts have been appealed independent of each other. They do look as though they have been severed. And Judge Stiff, what you're whether or not there was an order severing, of course, the defendants have always preserved through the five that have gone to trial, as Abbott Labs did. We asked for writs, but we preserved it, thinking we were going to raise this issue on appeal and say that the venue issue was that it should have been severed. And so those were preserved, but in answer to your... Now I've lost your question, so I'm going to ask you that again.
Well, the majority opinion didn't say one way or the other whether venue was appropriate, did it?
The majority opinion fairly said, in the situation that was in front of it, that you have one set for trial, but there's no renewal. The majority opinion says, we're assuming jurisdiction, in which Emerson is going to say, we're always distinguishing that because we're not ever agreeing that we have that. Mm-hmm. So should that be a starting point for looking at joinder? The defendants have always maintained across the board that joinder was inappropriately used in order to create venue. They're not giving that, and that argument was made in Barron but not renewed when the individual was set for trial separately. So that's what the defendants in the Tout cases did upon review of Emerson majority, because in the five cases before, the issues was set up like it was for appeal. So in the next one, immediately within 1 week of issuance of Barron, one gets set singularly for trial. That's why the defendants renewed it and asked that it be, now there are no, may I finish the sentence, Your Honor? Now there are no, necessarily no more efficiencies. It was the plaintiff that urged the Blaze claim to be set for trial. And the plaintiff asked it, there are no more efficiencies. Discovery was completed and it was set for trial. So in answer to that, then it is in accordance with the majority and the concurrence.
And I have an additional question. Can you address a question started to be asked in the last case? Are we just allowing piecemeal appeals, or is there a history and tradition of venue issues being decided prior to the trial on the merits? And should they be, or should this be part of the appeal after?
They should be.
And tell me why, or is that a
because it's
have they
been,
always been? Is this a new thing? What is the history of this?
You know, when it started, it used to be, as you the court all knows, it used to be jurisdictional. It used to be easy. You'd file a motion to dismiss for improper jurisdiction, case was dismissed and refiled. You didn't like that, it could be appealed. When it was not, then it became a little more difficult. It was always, the issues and the rules in the cases say that it is, if you don't raise it and originally it's waived, if you raise it and you ask for a written, it's denied, that's not binding, you just preserve it and ask for review on appeal. Historically, and I've been in many of them, you never get any relief on appeal when you ask for a writ. And so the majority opinion in the opinion of Emrys and its counsel is that the majority opinion was helpful, along with the concurrence, in saying, you know, those things, because venue is where a case should be tried, you should decide that before trial.
And there are dozens of cases where we've granted writs and determined venue prior to trial because you
absolutely
can't. After the fact, you'd have to retry a case in a proper venue?
Absolutely, because jurisdiction you still want, absolutely want, but if it's not, jurisdiction is its own animal. But venue, because it is tied to where it is efficient to try the case, it absolutely should be one handled by writ prior to trial, because it's very difficult to prove when you don't have any other errors in the case. How are you harmed by where it was really tried?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
It pleases the court. The reasons you've already expressed, this case is a bit different. Even though Emerus and Johnson failed to plead the each part of the concurring opinion, we do have the answer. Judge Burleson made it clear, we've set transcript citations in the back of our appendix, where he said, we've got to get to the place where we can try these cases in multiple plaintiffs. You just denied a writ where 22 had been set. January, I believe. And importantly, the Blaze case was originally, a trial began with two other plaintiffs. If you look at Johnson & Johnson's brief, page 11, they admit that that happened, but there was a mistrial declared when BMS came down in the midst of it and the jurisdictional issues were thrown into the air.
If I understand, I think counsel's argument is that for the plaintiff whose case is set, there's no more efficiency to be gained. So whatever Judge Burleson might learn about trying multiple of the remaining multiple plaintiffs together, he can still learn that no matter where the Blaze case, the set case, is tried. So the argument goes, move that one where it belongs, keep the rest of them in front of Judge Burleson. If he thinks he can try 2 or 12 or 22 together, fine. But the next time he cuts one off, and each time he sets one for trial, that trial occurs where venue would have been proper had that been the only claims, the only counts pled. And why is that wrong?
Well, it's wrong because of the rule. Respectfully. You either follow 5205 all the way through, and Rule 7401 takes care of the issues that Judge Price finished that I couldn't respond to. It allows there to be finally an appeal. There's not a need to wait. There's been money paid in the first of the Abbott cases. So the ecosystem about which I spoke earlier is the 5205 ecosystem. It is a very complete, comprehensive, and logical way of handling cases. Now, the way you undo that, it seems to me, is by a rule. And you may want to go to an MDL circumstance where you say all of these cases are going to be put together, but when the trial court decides that efficiencies are finished, send them back out to where they ought to go. That's what happens in MDL courts. As a practical matter, what happens in MDL courts is that a two or three are tried to try and jam a settlement down to everyone, even though that is not exactly what the MDL rule permits. Now, I know we don't have that rule, and Judge Wilson, I believe your concurring opinion is a step in that direction, and it may be the right policy. But it seems to me, respectfully, that either our rules apply as they are written, or we risk an adhocracy growing up that says we don't like what's happening here, despite the fact that our rules permit this, and so we're going to fix it as to this. And I think perhaps the most telling sentence in the concurring opinion is, this is probably not something that's going to continue to happen because of the BMS decision. All of these talc cases are now floating in the ether because the jurisdictional question has yet to be decided. There are claims that jurisdiction is proper in Missouri. Those are being very, very strongly defended. A decision will be made on those. It will not affect Abbott because Abbott failed to file a personal jurisdiction motion. But that said, I think respectfully that you either believe in Rule 5205 or you don't.
What about Rule 5101?
5101, if we're in venue.
Right, which
and,
says
and so let me,
the rules shall not extend venue of civil action. So if we're strictly applying the rules in the way you say and you can't interpret it to indicate severance would be appropriate in this situation,
well,
why was venue ever proper?
Respectfully, venue is set at the beginning of the case. Mm-hmm. And unless there are parties added or subtracted. And that was
Joinder can't be used to extend venue is what 5101 says. Is that being violated here?
Well, Your Honor, that's what it says. But I think you've now got to take into fact, account the fact that the 2005, the tort reform amendments began using a different word throughout the venue statute in its actions. And section 1.090, I believe, said where there are technical words being used, use the technical definition. It also says where you got a common word, use the common definition. Action is a technical word. The venue statute previously talked about suits. It now says actions. And it says, what is an action? Now, it doesn't define it in the venue statute. What it says is action is whatever it means in a technical sense. This court's rules say that a single action, one action, 5205, exists when people are properly joined. So then you have to say, well, what does the venue statute say if there is a single action? Well, you look at it. And the concurring opinion in this case says that not only was joinder proper here, but venue was proper. And the way you get to the place where venue is not proper is that you ultimately have to reach a conclusion that you sever. Because action is what's determined, and the word necessarily means one case, even though there are multiple claims joined together. That being the case, the issue is, can you properly sever once you're in the 5205 universe? The court gets to decide that. I suggest that you can't, largely because you then destroy the discretion in trial judges to handle these sorts of cases in a way that leads to what the rules say is the primary and overriding purpose of them, to create efficient determination of disputes as expeditiously as possible. Now, it may be the wrong policy, and the court gets to decide that. But if it does, it has to do it in a way that tells the trial court in advance, here's what's wrong. Now, if I pick up as a trial judge the concurring opinion, the first thing I see is each. Have I set each case for trial? Here we know the answer is no. I'm going to set some of them in groups. And if that's the rule I have to apply, then I can, with a straight face, say, I don't have to grant this motion to sever because I have not reached the decision that each case must be tried individually. That's how I read the concurring opinion. That's what the dictionary says I should read when I find the word each. Because there's another word, if the court meant it, would be if any case is set for trial.
Well, it seems like you're reading it to say if every case is set for individual trial. If I say I'm going to take each of my kids to dinner, I can take them together, or I can take them one, and then I can do the other. I've still taken each of them to dinner.
Well, you could, Judge, and if that's what you meant, I would suggest a different word would have been more instructive to the people reading it. But if that's what you meant, then you move on to the next question, and that is, do you ever get to the place where you can sever? And I still say you must be stuck within the ecosystem of 5205. You can't import 5206 into it, because that is about misjoinder. So if I file something that has nothing to do with another case, then I can have it separated, and it leaves the 5205 ecosystem. But this is a set of rules that have been developed, that have worked, that people understand how they work. And you either, I believe, as you suggested in your concurrence, suggest that joinder was improper at the beginning, or you just say, no, this rule only goes so far.
Well, now, if Judge Bertelsen had severed Blaze, are you saying that would have been error because he can't sever?
If he found that it was misjoined, yes.
No, but and I don't think it was misjoined. I've already said that. So you're saying that a claim properly joined cannot be severed for trial.
If joinder is proper, the glue holds them together the whole way through, and that's why the rule talks about separate trials. If the rule said sever, it knows how to use it because the very next rule says sever. 5205 only allows separate trials. So if joinder's correct, that glue holds everything together, and the way you handle these circumstances is the separate trial provision of 5205, I think it's B or C.
Joinder become incorrect later?
I don't see how it could be because the federal rules, which we quote, again, I understand what I just said, not a nice thing to say, but if you find it persuasive, it says you always look at these things at the beginning in the petition or the complaint. And that's where the decision is made. That's where the concurrence says, we've looked at the joinder question here, it's properly joined. From there, we leap to venue. Is this properly in the right venue? Absolutely, because joinder was proper. And then
And what happens if you try that one plaintiff who is the basis, the anchor? Then what happens to venue?
The anchor plaintiff, you said?
Mm-hmm. If that.
Well, then you get what happened here. Rule 7401 says, let's find out if I was right. It goes up. An appellate court says, yeah, it might be right or it's wrong. And then that then controls the rest of the cases. But it's part of this ecosystem. Taking it away may be exactly what the policy ought to be. But it's not the way the rule is written. And if Judge Breckenridge's opinion in Balmy, which all of you joined, as I recall, if I pronounced it correctly, is that the court is bound by its rules, just as everyone else is. And as I have said sort of until you must be tired of hearing it, because I'm tired of saying it, you may wish to have a different policy, but the only way you, I respectfully suggest, can do it is with a different rule. And the Constitution says how that has to happen. And so we're left now with a decision by a trial court that it wants to try and be efficient and expeditious. And as long as that remains open, as Judge Wilson said in the opinion, then we cannot convict a trial court of an abuse of discretion, which is the standard here. And so we're left with, is this the place the court wants to plant its flag? Where you have bad pleadings, where you have evidence that a trial court believes that expedition ought to take place, where you have jurisdiction floating around in the ether and no one knows what the answer is going to be, and in doing so, issue a writ, the rarest of rare things.
Why doesn't 5206 apply here, where it says misjoinder of parties is not a ground for dismissal of an action? Parties may be dropped or added by order of the court on motion of any party or its own initiative at any stage of the action. So that
dropped
indicates you could reconsider that at any stage of the action, doesn't it?
Judge, I believe.
And the last sentence is, any claim against a party may be severed and proceeded with it separately. Does it say in the case of misjoinder?
Well, do you just separate respectfully that sentence from the rest of it, which is all about misjoinder, or is it just you pull it out of there? I understand that the court can interpret its rules, and if it chooses to interpret them that way, that's the law. But I would suggest that's not how anybody's read this, and the federal courts that have looked at this, and one state court of appeals basically has looked at it, and has reached the conclusion that that's not what this is about. This is about preserving things like the statute of limitations and all of the rest of that in case there is misjoinder and you don't lose out on the filing date. You get the case transferred. Now, as I say, you can pick a sentence out of anywhere and make it apply everywhere. But within the context of that paragraph...
Well, but within one talking about misjoinder and severing cases for separate trial, that seems pretty on point. It's not being taken out of context. Why doesn't that govern?
Well, largely because the rules... If you look at the history of the federal rule from which this is copied, it is always applied only in the circumstance of misjoinder. And again, you
may... And does it say at any stage, and do they permit you to reconsider joinder at any stage the way this does?
I would assume that it could do that, but it would also feed that into the separate trial issue. Your Honors, these rules tell us how to operate. And it ought not to be a mystery or a secret to us, and we shouldn't change them in midstream, respectfully. The
Counsel,
trial...
Before your time is up, you made a statement that Blaze was initially set with two other cases.
And the trial began.
Mm-hmm. So it was set as a group, not individually by itself.
Right.
And that's, is that part of this record?
That's part of the record. It's admitted at page 11 of the Johnson & Johnson brief, where they... And it was interrupted only by the VMS decision. I have 26 seconds left. When I woke up this morning, I did not believe I would get close to taking 15 minutes on this particular. So I don't suspect I'm going to get back up here and get and say much, but I might. I thank the court for its time.
May it please the court. To start with Rule 5206, which is... The relators in both their briefs argue that rule gives the court discretion. What the respondent is advocating is that the court would have no discretion and no opportunity and no ability to drop or add a party or take up the issue and sever a case in the life of the case. Remember, in this case, we're on the fourth amended petition. The plaintiffs have been sought to be added to the petition over the defendant's objections throughout the course of the case. And the rule, the misjoinder and non-joinder rule itself does not limit it. And it would be the relator's urging that this court do exactly what the respondent asked. Should you plant a tree? Absolutely.
Are there cases that have applied 5206 as you're arguing it should be applied?
Let me think, Your Honor, if we put any in our brief, because the rule, we put the rule in our brief on its face, it would appear to give absolute discretion to the trial judge to do it any case, and I'm not aware of any case.
Well, it was adopted in 72, so the question is whether, as Mr. Robertson said, you're arguing a new interpretation of the rule, or whether there are cases that have interpreted it as you're arguing it should be interpreted.
I'm aware of no cases that interpret it the way they're arguing it, and I'll have to defer to Mr. Weaver, who will look, because our briefs are relatively the same, to answer whether we have, because at this moment, I can't recall that we have done anything more than provide you with the rule itself, which would appear to be consistent with the statute, that appears to be consistent if you're adding or removing parties. But if that issue is unclear and is not addressed, we'd ask permission to be able to do that.
It isn't unclear what the trial judge did here, though, right? The trial judge didn't sever. The trial judge did set it for a separate trial.
That's right, but we're complaining about his refusal to sever. And his comment about the transcript is a year before. You know, it is troubling to make sure the court has a full understanding of what the parties were doing. It's plaintiff that kept asking that Blaze be set for trial, whether it was set with two others or whether it was set alone. It is the plaintiff's repeated request that that be set for trial at the time that it came up for trial. So the reference in that there is no record in the Emeris, but in the J&J briefing, there is a portion of a transcript with Johnson & Johnson provides the rest. That's from 2016. That's way before we got to anything that we're here today on. And so in my limited seconds, it is the urging that providing a writ in this circumstance on venue and the situation that's before is imperative and important. What happens thereafter may need to be addressed in the cases that do something different. But in this case, in which there was a trial setting of an individual plaintiff that was clearly ready for trial because it already started before, would urge the court to make the writ permanent so that the trial judge would then order the severance, and then it would go to where it should be tried, which is St. Louis County. Thank you.